I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Phyllis Folb, Executive Director of the American-Israel Gap Year Association. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and welcome two new young representatives of Israel, our Shinshiniot Ron Benekot and Rotem Rappaport. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom! The long run of Jewish fall festivals finally concluded with the celebration of Simchat Torah last week, and we've entered the Jewish holiday-free zone that lasts all the way up to Hanukkah. There's even a special name for the month that begins this week, Cheshvan, the single month in the entire Jewish calendar year that contains no holidays. It's called Mar Cheshvan, literally the bitter month of Cheshvan. Bitter because there are no celebratory festivals to interrupt the mundane dailiness of life. But if you happen, like me, to be in the professional Jewish business, there is something refreshing about the conclusion of the month-long overload of holiday happenings. After a non-stop glut of festivals, celebrations, fasts, and feasts, it's actually a little bit of a relief, a machaya, to get back to something akin to regular life. I spent this past Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur through Sukkot leading services for Kehilat Shanghai in China and teaching and other things there, a fascinating experience in China that I'll share with you over the next few weeks. But after returning, I spent the rest of Sukkot recovering from jet lag and festival exhaustion. Please, don't get me wrong. I love the Jewish holiday season, and each festival has its own meaning and beauty. Each explores an important aspect of ritual, communal, and spiritual life. Every single festival, from Slichot through Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, from Sukkot to Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah, has something unique to teach us about how to live life well and meaningfully. But while this is an exhilarating period filled with festivities, it's also an exhausting time with many additional demands and requirements for a rabbi or cantor, or both, and even for the ordinary observant Jew. When we finally settle down to just regular Shabbat once a week, it is a genuine delight. I guess at some point you really can get too much of a good thing. In any case, as we move into the more normal parts of the Jewish year, our Torah reading cycle has begun again. Yesterday, we chanted the great portion of Bereishit, Genesis, and this coming week we'll read the story of Noah in the Torah and the epic of the flood. With the increased environmental volatility caused in part by global warming, we know that natural disasters are not just some archaic memory of an antique past. Instead, they literally flood across our news feeds and social media accounts without cessation these days, from Indonesia to North Carolina, which raises an important question. If God is good, and God has authority and power over the natural world that God created, why do such things occur? Why do natural disasters like floods wash away innocent human beings and animals with such frequency? There's a practical answer and a theological one. The practical answer to why do bad floods, hurricanes, earthquakes, tsunamis, and destructive wildfires happen to good people goes like this. Cataclysmic natural events have always been a part of the world God created. When there were no human beings or very few, these naturally occurring events, like tornadoes, volcanic eruptions, tidal waves, and so on, affected the landscape and the wild animals who lived there, but generally speaking, they weren't human disasters in any meaningful way. In our people-centric view of things, no men, women, or children were harmed in those natural disasters, and no property with real economic value was damaged. But as people became fruitful and multiplied and began to spread out over the land, in Genesis phrase, we moved into areas where these kinds of natural events caused great harm. We built cities on the shores of seas that could explode with tidal waves. We put settlements in the shadows of volcanoes that erupted and annihilated the residents. We planted vineyards in arid regions, watered the ground, and when the foliage became dense and dry, it became perfect fuel for wildfires. We moved to islands in the path of hurricanes, created major cities underneath earthen dams that we ourselves built, or in the floodplains of great rivers or oceans. And then we were shocked that natural disasters struck us in these vulnerable locations. I realize this isn't much biblical consolation to those who lose relatives, homes, businesses, pets, lives to flood, fire, or earthquake. But the truth is that God doesn't cause these naturally occurring events to become disastrous for human beings. We do that by insisting on placing ourselves in what can only be reasonably described as harm's way. And that's without even acknowledging the ways we change our own landscape through reconstructing it and creating situations in which disasters are more likely to occur. Or the ways that by polluting our environment, we bring about some of the physical changes that put us directly at risk. Put another way, the reality is that natural disasters are natural. Our ability to control them, however, is very, very limited. This may not be comforting, but it does put us very much back in the same boat that Noah was in, if you forgive the pun. We float along, rudderless, and know in our hearts that God is the only one who truly determines where and when we will land. What we do control is where we put ourselves in the first place, and what we do once we reach shore. To play us in this morning on this theme, here's a song about, well, exactly that, from a long-ago Richard Rodgers musical based on a Clifford Odets play about Noah. The song is called When It Dries. The singer is the late Danny Kaye.
Why are you so gloomy? We're alive and we're afloat. After 40 days and nights, it's shipshape on the boat. Look, the sun's come out again and turned a rosy red. How can you be gloomy when you think of what's ahead? It's gonna be some terrific place when it dries, when it dries. You're gonna see wide and open space when it dries, when it dries. It's gonna be some terrific place. You're gonna see wide and open space. We're gonna have such a human race when it dries. The greenery's gonna have a shine when it dries,
when it dries.
The world'll be full and fat and fine when it dries, the greenery's gonna have a shine. The world'll be full and fat and fine.
The best thing of all, it's one third mine when it dries.
Half a million growing things will spring up from the ground.
Half a million bodies will be floating all around.
Room to work and grow and build a company of men.
Think about how much we can contaminate again.
There's gonna be air beyond compare when it dries,
when it dries.
With drinkable water everywhere
when it dries, when it dries. There's gonna be air beyond compare with drinkable water everywhere.
As long as you don't have people there when it dries,
when it dries,
when it dries.
When it dries, when it dries. Remembering how he vents his wrath when it dries. We're going to walk a righteous path. Remembering how he vents his wrath.
That when he got mad, we took some bath.
When it dries.
That was When It Dries from the musical 2x2 about Noah, this week's Torah portion that we'll read in synagogue. Still a meaningful metaphor for our own lives and our conduct in this world that God has given us. When students graduate from high school, there's an opportunity to use the year that follows, the one before college, in a remarkable and productive way. The gap year allows students to develop emotionally, academically, and spiritually before entering college. Perhaps the best way for Jewish teens to use that year is by spending it in Israel, connecting with their Jewish heritage and the extraordinary nation that embodies it. Our guest this morning, Phyllis Fulb, the executive director of the American Israel Gap Year Association, helps make that possible for teens all over the country. Find out about the gap year, why this program is so important, when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish Phyllis Fulb. She's the creator and head of the American Israel Gap Year Association, changing lives through a gap year experience. Mission is to make the breadth of that year after high school into college into an opportunity for students across the denominational spectrum, bringing them to Israel and giving them an incredible experience. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
So when I was young, you graduated and you went on to college, and then when you finished college, you went on to work. That's not how it works so much nowadays for kids.
Well, the beauty of it is that, traditionally speaking, actually, Jewish... there is a tradition in Jewish life that people do go to school and then take their time in Israel. This dates back hundreds of years when young men, particularly, were going off to study in yeshivas after their formal, say, education. And then certainly coming up in the more contemporary world, you know, we saw a huge influx of students taking trips and serving their time in at kibbutz on Israel, et cetera, pretty much in the 70s it started. There is a history in the Jewish community of indeed going to Israel after their formal education. What's changed, however, is the breadth of programs that are available and the support that the world has now sees, the value the academic world sees in this period of time between high school and college, and it's the formulation of a more mature and focused young adult.
What prompted you? You have a background in educational consulting. What prompted you to create the American Israel Gap Year Association? Explain a little bit about why it's so important.
Well, there was literally a vacuum, I felt, out there in terms of people knowing the breadth of possibilities of that's available in Israel. I mean, Israel is a leader in everything, in from technology to medical to art, science, agriculture, etc. And people were not aware, young students and educators weren't really aware of all the programming and possibilities there were out there. And there was nobody to guide them. And that's what I heard a lot from parents and students alike, even those students and parents that did indeed go to Jewish schools, and they did were fortunate enough to have Israel counselors. Each school has a certain mission, you should say. So the kinds of programs, the gap year, I like to call them, frankly, this particular period of time, a bridge year or a transition year, because I do feel that the foundation that you have laid as a parent or an educator that we have, there's this part of their life. And then, of course, there's the college part of their life. But this period of time is that transitional year, that bridge year that takes them from that foundation you've laid to actually building the house, which is where they start to do that in college. So what I was finding was that many students, whether they had the benefit of a Israel counselor at their local school or they went to a public school and did not have had a wonderful counselor but didn't have a counselor that was aware of gap year programs, there was nowhere for them to turn. They had to kind of, when the internet existed, they could search the internet, but who was going to guide them? Who had inside information? Who had the relationships with these places? And there needed to be somebody who could listen to them, both the parent and the student, separately and to collectively, to see what their needs were. Who are they as a family? Who are they as individuals? What do they want to achieve? You know, who do they want to be when they grow up, so to speak? And to find the program, I call it, you know, finding their right direction. You can't fit a square peg into a round hole. And because every school has their own set of ideals about how this student should end up, we see ourselves as an objective and inclusive resource for families and educators. We can see the whole picture, the whole scope, and find the program that's right for them if indeed they want to use that service. If they want to come, we also, our cornerstone event, of course, is a big fair that we do. And many of our programs, we have about 50 Israel programs that come to the site in Los Angeles, although we get students that come really all over the East, and I have counseling students all over the country, to meet these people face-to-face and get a feel for the programs that are available to them. And that's the idea, that we're inclusive. Even the schools appreciate it because they may have a certain school that they have to promote, but it might not be right for this particular family. But we have that program at our fair or have access to that program, and we can help those students do it. So my passion for doing this was to fill that void. And on a personal level, I have to tell you that my own two daughters went to Israel in their gap year, and I thought I laid a pretty good foundation for them as a family, Jewish parent, and somebody who was involved in the community. And yet, they each had to find their own way. It was that gap year, that year that they each chose something completely different, changed their lives, really, really changed their lives. And I sort of felt like I wanted to pay it forward.
We will continue with Phyllis Fold talking about the gap year programs and what you actually do on those years when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, our maven on Israel. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So now that all the holidays are behind us, it's time to think about going to Israel. You're leading a trip to, co-leading a trip to Israel with many, many other people. Tell us about the trip, but tell us also why, in your view, it's important to go to Israel.
I think it's very simple. You know, first of all, the Weintraub Israel Center really emphasizes on building relationship with Israel and with Israelis. And you can't really build relationship without a person-to-person contact. Learning about Israel in a classroom is one thing. Visiting Israel and seeing in your own eyes and experiencing it from your own eyes and build your own story of Israel is important in my eyes. And I can share with you just one small thing that I've been a classroom teacher for many, many years, middle school and high school. And I've taught about Israel. That was one of the topics. And when I had like a modern Israel class. And so I can sit there and talk about an operation, a military operation that started, you know, just to bring back home three teenagers who were kidnapped. But we happened to be in Israel with 11th graders, and we happened to be in one of the special forces that went out to search for them. And we went to an empty base. And when the children asked me, the teens asked me, "Mr. Eden, what's going on? Why is this base empty?" And I said, "The truth. They're all out there searching for our brothers." So this is something that, you know, you can't teach in a classroom. And I strongly encourage every listener of our program to go to Israel. Go alone, go with your family, go with Weintraub Israel Center, but just go to Israel. It's very important.
Go with your synagogue. You know,
go with your synagogue, of course, with any organizations.
No, I think it's
great. The more, the better.
You know, in leading a trip, there's so many different ways you can go. Okay, everybody's going to go to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, right?
That's a given, yeah. Masada.
It's a law. You go to Masada. You've got people who are there for the first time, of course, see the Dead Sea.
Yes.
Go to the Galilee, see the Kinneret.
Right.
All of those, but that's not really the most important part of Israel, mm-hmm. Although hard to argue with Jerusalem.
Right.
What do you think the most important connection people make is?
Well, to be honest, you know, there are two things. One is, of course, you know, cover the tourist attraction, cover the things that are most important to
holiest places.
Right,
for
of
Jews,
course, of course, of course. But I actually have a different angle outside of the box, which is, I think, you know, to look at your passion. Look at your passion. What is it you like? Because Israel, yes, it's the Jewish state and it's a very special place, but it's a country with people who wake up in the morning and go to work and provide to their families and play sports and, you know, and read together and hike together or alone. And they do things that we do. And so I think that if you look at your passions and you try to match them and you go and you visit real people, you know, and you coordinate ahead of time and have the same interest and have the same passions. And then you not only visited Israel, but you bring Israel back with
home
you.
With you.
Yes.
It's a great way to be. Thanks so much, Amir. We'll talk next week.
You're welcome.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about the phenomenon of ultra-right or nationalist tribalism, I think is a term that you used, that's developed a variety of places all around the globe, and its impact, where it's come from, and its impact also on the Jewish communities in those places. I'm not sure where to begin. It's sort of sprouting various places, but maybe Eastern Europe might be the best place to begin.
Well, okay, so you spent some significant time in Poland this summer, and you saw a thriving and, if anything, growing and flourishing Jewish community in a country that was once widely considered a hotbed of anti-Semitism. And Poles by themselves are basically 100% Catholic and nationalist, and now at least fairly right-wing. But the question is, okay, so being right-wing doesn't necessarily translate into violent anti-Semitism. Being in a country governed by a right-wing government doesn't necessarily mean that life gets worse for the Jews. But historically, it's been dangerous for Jews, because historically what has happened to bring extreme right-wing parties to power and to have right-wing governments in place is great social strain, whether that's economic, political, military, whatever, the sense that the society is under siege and that the
old danger of collapse,
right, the old ways are in danger of disappearing, and we have to cling on fiercely to what we already know, because there's safety in what we know and there's danger in the unknown. And that atmosphere, that set of attitudes, certainly is what brought Hitler to power. It brought other notoriously bad, evil, right-wing regimes to power over the years. And I think what's interesting in terms of looking at the world today and the resurgence of right-wing extremism, as well as sort of identity politics and tribalism, is that the world as a whole, as it becomes increasingly globalized and increasingly digitalized, is undergoing an unprecedented degree of rapid social and technological change. I mean, if you compare the world of 2018 with the world of 1918, they're unrecognizably different. And there has never been a century in history where there was such rapid change in so many dimensions of human existence. So I would argue, and it's an argument I'm only going to be able to begin this week, but I would argue that such rapid, sweeping change in so many areas of our lives makes people scared and uncomfortable and seeking certainties. And certainties are offered by the extreme right, by sticking with what we know, and by ruling out the unknown, whether that's minorities or new opinions or tribes that are not exactly like us in terms of their beliefs, their appearance, their practice, et cetera, et cetera.
So that kind of, well, we'll come back to this next week. By the way, I should also note that there are places where extremely strong left-wing regimes have not been so great for Jews either. But let's come back to that question of the technological change and its impact on this sort of mentality next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Toward the end of Shabbos morning services, Rabbi Goldstein asks his congregation, "On Yom Kippur a couple of weeks ago, I asked you to all forgive your enemies. So, how many of you have forgiven all your enemies?" 80% of the congregation holds up their hands. Rabbi Goldstein asks again, "Come on now, you can do better than that. How many of you have forgiven your enemies?" This time, everybody raises their hand, except one elderly man, Mr. Steinberg. "Well, Mr. Steinberg," says the rabbi, "it's good to see you here today. Good Shabbos. Aren't you willing to forgive your enemies?" "I don't have any," the old man replies gruffly. "Mr. Steinberg, that's amazing. How old are you?" "I'm 98 years old," he replies proudly. The congregation oohs, ahs. "Okay, Mr. Steinberg, please tell us how a person can live 98 years and not have a single enemy in the whole world." The old man slowly rises, faces the congregation, and says simply, "I've outlived all the momsers." You see, a momser is, not a complimentary term. Anyway, that was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and outlive them all. Welcome our Shin Shiniyot, our representatives, young representatives of Israel from the Weintraub Israel Center, Ron Benekot and Rotem Rappaport. Boker Tov, happy end of all of these many Chagim. Good morning.
Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So you've just gone through the American Jewish holiday cycle, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Simchat Torah, all this stuff. Tell us, like, how it feels differently from how that experience would be in Israel.
So in Israel, like, I feel like on top of all the holidays, the basic idea is freedom from work and school. So a lot of people use this.
Especially freedom from school if you're a student.
Yeah, that's right. So just the freedom from school and work, and it's all the holidays together is one big vacation, you can say, and people are using it to, you know, just go to vacations and just chill out and like start the year fresh. And here, because it's not you don't get like
time off of school. Sukkot is not a school vacation in America.
Yeah, exactly. So it's more based on the Jewish traditions and Sukkah, but outside of work and school. And in Israel, it's like combined together, the freedom and the holidays. So it's such great times here and in Israel. When Israel, you really feel it in the environment outside of everything, in the streets and in
newspapers,
the cities,
and the media, online. Right.
Yeah, everywhere. And here it's only on the on the congregations and Jewish places, you can really feel the environment.
I think that's a great, great point. You know, it's not as though, I don't know, Amazon or the websites in America are all decorating their...
Right, exactly.
With you know, Shofarot or Sukkot or yeah, something.
That could be good.
Yeah, there's a profit market here, I think, for them, if they think about it.
Yeah.
Small, but, you know, there it is. In a way, does that make it seem like the holidays are sort of an extra that makes them a little heavier here, perhaps?
I think that I've just learned to appreciate the holiday even more because it's not everywhere, like Otam said, like in Israel, and you need to look for it, and I feel like that we really want that, so you need to find it like at the congregations or at Jewish houses or Jewish institutions around here. And when you do find it, it's amazing because you feel like...
You found your home.
Yeah, like your home, your family, yeah. And it's amazing.
So in a funny way, the holidays make you appreciate being Jewish more when you're outside of Israel.
Exactly.
And you find your Israel in the synagogue or the Jewish center, yeah. Wherever it is that you happen to be.
Exactly. The community is our home.
Wonderful. Well, we have a long time without holidays now, so
but
they've been great. Happy end of Chagim, and we will talk next week.
Thank you.
Bye.
And now a word of Torah about Noah. It's an old story and we know it well. God sees that wickedness and corruption have spread throughout the world, that human beings are acting in ways that should have been predictable to an all-knowing deity. Lying, cheating, stealing, committing adultery, tweeting falsehoods, the usual. In response, God decides to destroy the world in a great flood, rain falling for 40 days and nights, the whole of humanity drowned in deluge. One man is chosen to survive the flood because the Torah text tells us he was righteous in his generation, Ish Tzadik Bedorotav. Noah, Noach in Hebrew, is chosen to carry the banner of humanity to the next generation. Gathering his family about him and two of each animal, plus seven pairs of each kosher animal, so there's something to eat and something to sacrifice to God if they make it out, Noah builds the ark, loads the boat, and goes not on a three-hour cruise, but one long enough to float away every trace of the depravity of humanity in those days. Eventually, Noah sends out first a raven and then finally a dove to see if the world is dry enough to land upon. The dove brings back a famous olive branch. They land and exit the ark, and life begins again. A great covenant is affirmed, the first and most enduring breach in human history. God agrees never again to destroy the earth by flood. We agree to abide by certain minimum standards of morality. It's truly a new beginning. In essence, God acknowledges that this new world will not be the Garden of Eden anymore, but it can be both physically and morally good and rich. Noah, we are told, was a righteous man in his generation, Ish Tzadik Bedorotav, but that doesn't necessarily make him a righteous man in every generation. The Zohar explains that when Noah was told about the destruction of humanity, he complied with God's command to build the ark and save his family and the animals, but he did not protest the destruction of people. Unlike Abraham or Moses, who argued against similarly devastating divine decrees, Noah goes with the flow, as it were. He submerges his compassion for his fellow creatures. Noah might be better than the others in his generation, but he is not a hero for the ages. He's just the best of a bad lot. Nonetheless, he does set a reasonable standard that we can live up to. If we can't necessarily succeed in becoming fully righteous for all time, at least we can strive to be righteous in our own turbulent times, hard as that may be. All that's required is that we try to be the best we personally can be. Seek to be ethical and good, even when it seems easier to choose not to be so. If we can do that, choose to be at least as good as Noah, we too might end up saving the world. One simple mitzvah, one act of goodness, kindness, and gentility at a time. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Phyllis Fulb, will explain what a high school graduate can gain out of a gap year program in Israel and just how incredibly valuable that experience can be. Find out when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Federal prosecutors announced the arrest of four men who took part in last year's violent Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, where one counter-protester was murdered and dozens injured. Benjamin Daly, Thomas Gillen, Michael Macellus, and Cole White were charged last week with conspiracy to incite a riot in Charlottesville. They are affiliated with the Rise Above movement, a small white ultra-nationalist organization based in Southern California, of all places, noted for its use of violence and promotion of Islamophobic and anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. This case should serve as another example of the Department of Justice's commitment to protecting the life, liberty, and civil rights of all our citizens, U.S. Attorney Thomas Cullen said. Any individual who has plans to travel to this district with the intent to engage in acts of violence will be prosecuted and held accountable. Other rioters and protesters have been indicted for last summer's violence, including Alex Fields, who drove his car into the crowd of counter-protesters, killing anti-racism activist Heather Heyer. The march, originally billed as a demonstration to defend Confederate statues, included chants of "The Jews will not replace us." A number of protesters in Charlottesville passed by a local synagogue screaming anti-Semitic epithets. In positive news, the ridiculous overrepresentation of Jews among Nobel Prize winners continued last week with the arrival of the oldest Nobel laureate of all. Jews have won about 24% of all Nobel Prizes in history, in spite of the fact that we represent significantly less than 1% of the world's actual population. This time, the Nobel winner is in an often Jewish category, physics. Three researchers, including a Jewish American, won the 2018 Nobel Prize in Physics for inventions in the field of laser physics. Physics laureate Arthur Ashkin, 96 years old, retired in 1992 after 40 years at Bell Labs in New Jersey, but he remains active in a home laboratory. He is now the oldest ever Nobel laureate. Ashkin started his work on manipulation of microparticles with laser light in the late 60s, which resulted in the invention of optical tweezers in 1986. They can grab particles, atoms, viruses, and other living cells with their laser beam fingers. They've resulted in the invention of advanced precision instruments used in corrective eye surgery and in industry. Ashkin won half the $1 million prize, with Gerard Moreau of France and Donna Strickland of Canada sharing the other half, for together developing a method to generate ultra-short optical pulses, also used in corrective eye surgery. Strickland is the first woman to receive the physics prize in 55 years. Ashkin is also known for his studies in photorefraction, second harmonic generation, and nonlinear optics and fibers. Just because I can read these words does not mean I understand them. But, of course, Ashkin certainly does. He holds 47 patents. His parents were Jewish immigrants to the U.S. from the Ukraine. They married, settled in Brooklyn, where Ashkin was born. He got his Ph.D. in nuclear physics from Cornell University. And in a case with a significant dappled patina of irony, a French court last week ordered that an 1887 Camille Pissarro Impressionist painting must be returned to the heirs of its Jewish owner, after rejecting an appeal by an American Jewish couple who had sued to retain ownership of the painting. Got all that? The current owners, Bruce and Robbie Toll, loaned the artwork La Culette des Pois, or Picking Peas, to the Marmottan Museum in Paris, where it was discovered by relatives of Simon Bauer, a wealthy businessman whose assets, including 93 paintings, were seized in 1943 by the wartime Vichy French government that collaborated with the Nazis. In May this year, a Paris court granted Simon Bauer's descendants' request to have the painting impounded while waiting for the court to rule on ownership. Bauer family attorney Cedric Fisher said the ruling was significant because it gives victims of the savagery committed by the Vichy government the right to recover their looted possessions without a time limit. The Tolls, who are also Jewish and major patrons of Holocaust museums in both the U.S. and Israel, bought the painting at an auction at Christie's, New York in 1995 for $800,000. They have said they were unaware it was stolen. They do not consider that it is up to them to pay for the crimes of the Vichy regime, their lawyer said. Camille Pissarro was a major 19th-century Danish-French impressionist from the Caribbean and the most significant Jewish artist of the whole Impressionist movement. Approximately 100,000, or less than a sixth of the artworks looted by the Nazis, have been returned to date. This case, ironically, pitted the current Jewish owners against Jewish owners robbed by French Nazi collaborators. Justice has now been served, but in this case, it is a somewhat bittersweet victory. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Phyllis Volb is Executive Director of the American Israel Gap Year Association, which works on creating opportunities through its gap year conferences for all of those high school graduates or coming high school graduates, rising high school seniors who have the opportunity to go and spend a year in Israel on a really sometimes life-changing experience. Tell us a little bit about the kinds of experiences that students have. You mentioned you have personal experience with your own kids, and what the variety of programs are that you offer.
Well, you know, we are a resource. I mean, they're not my programs.
That are offered,
but there are many programs that are available. And those range the gamut from traditional learning programs that, you know, were around for time immemorial, which are religious learning programs, and that's across the denominational spectrum. And then, there's career development programs, things like learning about technology and Startup Nation and that kind of thing. I have many students who want to feel very patriotic and connection to Israel and want to join the IDF. And we have programs called Mahina programs that introduce them, put them in touch with families and other Israeli families and Israeli peers who also take a year or some time before they join the Army so that they can make sure that that's what they want to do. Gives them an insight. And I have many students who all go on and ultimately do become lone soldiers and do serve in the IDF. We also have things for internships, programs for, you know, academic programs in which they can earn college credit and also experience travel and see the history of Israel and all its components, and internships in all the gamuts of things from medical to agriculture to fashion to just business technology, et cetera. So it really runs the gamut, and we try to find a program that would suit that particular student and their need.
When you set up these fairs, how do you end up deciding where to go? How are these connections made?
Well, depending on if they come to the fair, of course, they can meet directly with those representatives. And if they come to us for counseling, we can make recommendations of programs that we think might be a good fit for them. And then there are applications online. And so, and you know, we can make, you know, meetings with them so that they can have a better sense of how to do it. But all the applications are online. But once you find the program that you might want to do, then you can make that application. We can either help you or you can, most people do it on their own, or if they have a counselor, they do it, just like you would fill out a college application.
Tell us a little bit about how people are attracted to it. Is it the organizations themselves that put on the programs that bring them in? How do you reach out to people?
How do we reach out to people?
Yes.
Typically our reach has been through many of the Jewish schools, but we also reach out to the public schools and secular private schools that have large Jewish populations that usually have Israel clubs or involved in things of the, you know, Hebrew language system, or something like that, and we try to let them know about the services that we offer and also the fair that's available to them. And so that's how we reach out to them. And of course, we are online at www.israelgapyear.org, so people come to us and find us. Many of our sponsors that include Masa Israel Journey and Stand With Us and Jewish National Fund and a variety of places know us and make referrals, and many of the high schools across the country, make referrals. So that's how they can know us. So that, and we have a few, something like you, to let people know that we're out here.
Right. The Two Jewish Radio Show. Absolutely.
Two Jewish Radio Show.
How many students have been impacted through your programs? How do you, how, How do you keep track?
Well, we keep track. We have a testimonial group. They come back to me and they tell me, you know, what their year's been. I would say 80% of the students that come to our fairs do go to Israel in a gap year. And then we have now as our counseling has picked up across the country, we know that those students particularly go because they're coming to me specifically to find a gap year program for them. So we have a nice track record. I would say across the board, the California is the largest of the West that sends their students to Israel, but I do have students from San Francisco and your own Arizona area that come to my fair, San Diego, Huntington Beach, Seattle, Las Vegas, all attend. So we have a nice broad range of students that come.
So if somebody is interested in taking a year off after high school or doing something different, not so much taking a year off, but having an additional experience before going on to college, their parents, I assume, are often involved in that decision. Gosh knows we go to a lot of college tours. They then can reach out to America Israel Gap Year Association and find out about programs across really a broad spectrum, right? If you go to one program, you'll only hear about that one program, but you guys can provide things. Is there an ideological spread? Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, we're complete. Well, I really pride myself on that. We are the only cross-denominational fair in the country, and certainly that's our mission, to make it open to wherever that student might be, whether it's a day school student, whether it's a student who experienced their Jewish life through camping or at their Shabbos table, or maybe if it's just lox and bagel on Sunday morning.
Right.
Whatever that student's and family's Jewish experience is, we're there to help them because Israel is theirs. It belongs to them too. And I often try to say that Judaism is like an orchestra. There's the strings and the winds and the brass and the percussion, and each are beautiful, have beautiful sounds and beautiful music, but together they really can make a beautiful concerto. And it's our goal to, we're not in the business of looking at how they're going to turn out. We're not looking to make them turn out a certain way, except that we want them to take ownership of their Jewish identity, whatever that means to them, and to have a deep and lasting relationship with Israel. That's our mission. So we are very much pride ourselves in being cross-denominational. And we're the model in across the country. We're the only cross-denominational program. So usually it's one or the other. So we're very proud about that.
So, you know, Birthright has had a tremendous impact. I think it's a very positive program. But a Birthright trip to Israel is a 9, 10, maybe 11-day trip. You might extend it a week or two. Can you sort of explore the distinctions? Because a lot of people think, well, my kid's going to Birthright.
Certainly, you know, Birthright has made a tremendous impact on the young adult Jewish community. But the way I kind of try to explain it and create a vision, if you will, I see these short-term trips to Israel as a summer romance, okay? This is where you fall in love. This is where you're deeply and passionately engaged, okay? But precisely the long-term programs, these programs are where you actually get engaged. This is where you want to build a life together. This is the person that you want to know, what kind of life am I going to lead? What kind of values does this have? You know, you want the deeper connection that you get during your engagement period. So each are valuable, you know, this burst of passion and this long-term exploration of your love is important. But that is the distinction that I say. All of them are valuable. Your family trips to Israel, the short-term trips, your camp with your school, for goodness sakes, you should totally take them. That's what's going to inspire these students. But to sit down and have that long-term that's going to be sustainable, that's going to make them more engaged in Jewish life on campus and beyond in their life, that's where the long-term program comes in.
Can you tell us a couple of stories, because stories really convey ideas so well, about I want to say kids, but about young adults who've gone on gap year programs that you've made the connection and then you've heard afterwards about some of the impact?
It's funny. I was just going to pull up one of my students just wrote me recently and was telling me how he used a new term called adulting.
Adulting. It's now a gerund. My goodness.
Yes, adulting. That his gap year program was how he became an adult, because his particular program, this is what he called it, and I'll write this little thing that he just told me. He said, "My gap year instilled in me many benefits, both practical and personal, that I still use today. My greatest achievement was the sense of independence gained, though not without some struggle. My gap year program emphasized self-reliance and independent living, basically what I call adulting. Not only did I learn how to travel alone, but also cooking, cleaning, budgeting, and many of the skills that are necessary for living an independent life." You know, and then he goes on to tell me about his
Jewish connection. Yeah.
Yeah, his other connections that he made. But I think that that is one of the things that we want, you know, colleges, you know, I mean, I don't know if the secular colleges are now encouraging, where in the old days, Jewish students had to really finagle a way to take that year off and defer. They don't have to do it because the colleges, you know, across the board are very supportive of it, because they see that the retention rate for their students is enormous, and the academic success rate has improved. I mean, the United States has an unfortunate dropout rate in the freshman year, because many students put so much emphasis on getting the grades and getting in and SAT scores that once they get there, they don't know why they're there. There's not a sense of purpose. But they're finding, the secular colleges, that these gap year students have a sense of purpose and meeting, and they're much more goal-directed and mature and ready to sit down and do what you need to do to be successful in both the academic world, but ultimately in their chosen profession. So very encouraging gap year, and that's what students, gain the most. I'm going to, in terms of what other students have said, I'm going to just pull somebody out, one of my other students. One woman wanted to get more in touch with her, Jewish experience.
Sure.
And so she, was searching out a program that could, could help her in that regard. I'm just going to see if I can find it.
That's okay. Phyllis, we're out of time, but where can people go to find out more about the American Israel Gap Year Association and how to connect with a gap year program?
They can, as I said before, www.israelgapyear.org, and we'll be happy to help you. Or info@aigya.org.
No charge for all of this, and people can find out.
Well, there's no charge to come to the fair, and there is some small, all donation to the individual counseling.
Sure.
And that does require a little more, one-on-one work.
Right.
But for the most part, all our things are there for your benefit. And on the website, there's a list of programs, a list of scholarships available. This year, for the first year, we are providing a scholarship for fair attendees that can get an application. So we hope to see as many people as possible come to the fair, and we have it every fall. But if you can't come to the fair, we are still here for you on our website and personally.
Thanks so much, Phyllis. When we come back here on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Devir Bargal, the expert on the Shanghai Ghetto, the remarkable story of the Jews of Shanghai, China. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes and at our TooJewishRadio.com website, top 10 podcasts in North America. Our playout this morning is a new single from Israeli star Idan Reichel, a past guest of Too Jewish, and classical guitarist Lawson Rollins. It's called And If You Will Come to Me. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.